91.5 FM WMFO. Brett Weinstein and Majid Nawaz, recorded at the end of June 2022 in London, England. Brett's podcast is called The Dark Horse Podcast. Majid Nawaz's show, Radical, is on Odyssey.com, video website. The remainder of this conversation is 40 minutes. Now back to the show.
That's good.
Until they start making Rocky 6, 7, 8, 9, they can just get silly.
Yeah.
But 1 and 2 were great films. And it's a great film anyway. But I think I give these film analogies because not everybody, people sometimes, I think it's serious topics. It's good to keep it like, you know, light for people to understand as well. And I think that that gives hope because, yeah, we are outmanned. There's a huge, huge problem out there, which is far bigger than you can take and I can take on our own or even combined, right? We have found each other. That's another good point though, right? As in not, we already knew each other, but within who we knew, we then found each other within a group of people that was already pretty damn good, yeah. Right? Yeah, so that's an advantage because again, back to the relational thing, there's nothing more powerful than a relationship that is based on an ideal as opposed to material value that can expire, you know?
I think that's true. I think we need to learn some of the lessons, you know,
you mentioned a point about collaboration or
remember when we confederation.
Spoke? Yeah, confederation. Yeah. Talk about that a bit.
Well, I mean, I think we are all of the people who do have good instincts about seeing through the nonsense all have the same fatal flaw, really, which is that they tend to be more lone wolf, right? The way you end up with enough independence of mind to spot the nonsense is something that causes you to be a little less, team oriented.
Yeah.
And the problem is that we need to make teams that work. And so we don't have that skill set in high enough concentration. So that's an issue that we need to address.
That's a difficult combination to find, by the way, but by definition, what you just said.
Right. Well,
self-selecting.
Right. But you know, I do think actually, and this goes in a very different direction, but there's sort of an ongoing conversation about important, what I would call myths, right? These are stories that resonate sometimes over thousands of years that are really important. But I think it is also interesting to watch the ways in which they change, right? So my little toolkit says you can't write a myth. You can write a story, and if it is sufficiently important and useful, it will evolve into a myth. It will be changed over time, and it will be altered until it is distilled down to something really resonant, right? And what I wanted to point to is that our myths are evolving, right? There is a sort of hero's journey, right? But there are also lots of versions of the hero's journey that do involve weird superheroes that come together with different skill sets.
Right. And then part ways again.
Well, they're never fully the same, and they are, you know, so it is asymmetrical partnerships and all of this. So that's interesting. We can also look at, you know, The Matrix is obviously not the first update of Plato's Cave, but it's the same basic idea. And, you know, it has another dynamic too, right? It, you know, Plato's Cave does not end well, mm-hmm. right? The Matrix is a different story, and I'm going to pretend that there are no sequels. I haven't even seen them because I know they're no good. But The Matrix.
Apparently, the one that was just made, I haven't even seen that one, but I have seen the other sequels, and yes, just watch number one.
Yeah.
But apparently, this one that was just made, it was made by the people that didn't like the fact that The Matrix became a red pill reference. So the studio insisted that the original writers come back, and the original writers didn't want to do it. The trans twins, right? I think,
yeah.
They didn't want to do it. This is a story around this, right? And they didn't want to do it. And then the studio said, well, we're going to make it with or without you. So you come back and write this. So then came back voluntarily, but it was going to be done if they didn't. So they had to come back.
So I think what you're telling me is that the agents got control of the studio. And the reason that the initial sequels weren't any good was that those were written in order to defend the whatever it is that makes The Matrix.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. but okay. So, you know, look,
the story is all, by the way, so you just touched on something. I don't know if you realized it, but this remake, this one, they just, it is all about that, going into that story, and then like it's like the little it's like, you know, like Adaptation, the film.
Yes.
It's like that kind of, and also Nick Cage's recent one, the beautiful, what was it called, Nick Cage's recent film, The Wonderful Burden of Fame or something. You'll see it. It's a title like that, which is riffing off a Beautiful Mind, a previous film. So it's a similar adaptation story plot. And so I think the latest Matrix has done the same thing. And so, they think it's intelligent filmmaking if they do that.
Let's hope they're right.
Yes. Because I haven't seen it, I'm not going to give a judgment on it.
Yeah. No, let's not review it if we haven't seen it. That would be somehow wrong. Yeah. But, you know, look, we have discovered that we are in something Matrix-like, right? The information environment is so polluted that we have to figure out, you know, how to shut down the Matrix and see the world for what it is, and, you know, and grapple with the terror that comes from recognizing just how captured the system has become. But we also do have stories that, you know, that properly, if you look at them right, that warn us. And we also have old stories, you know, we have—
They are so important, these stories.
Right, yeah. And we have Orwell, and, you know, and not just Orwell, we have, you know, we have Brave New World, we have Catch-22, we have Brazil. Lots of these things have something to tell us, and there are lots of people who are now awake, don't know what to do, but the real question is, can we level up faster than the other thing, that the thing that we're up against levels up against?
So let's drill down on this on an ideological perspective, yeah? So if you look at our existence and society, so we are outlived, as you correctly pointed out, by myths that survive not just us, but through lineage survive generations. And so the myths are bigger than us.
Yeah.
And they serve us by giving us a sense of anchorage or perspective in our position vis-a-vis those myths. And that is a large part of who we are, right? You can't divorce us from those myths, even if you try and rebel against them. Like, look at the anti-theist movement, right? You're trying to rebel against something in an anti-theist way, which I don't subscribe to, in an anti-theist way that is still defining yourself against the very myth that brought you to this point. You can't divorce yourself from those myths, no matter how much you try. Because we are all a product of these sort of overarching narratives that create the very, you know, a corporation is an entity, even though it's not a physical thing, because it's a fiction that everyone agrees on, like money. Yeah, these are fictions that everyone agree on. And so culture defining myths are like those. They are things that everybody's agreed on, but have been passed on through generations. So like corporations have their own life. So important. What they lead to, those myths, is to constructing the fundamental social contracts that we find ourselves in over time with a delayed reaction. That's how they manifest. So we only have law because of the religious myths that we adopted in the Abrahamic faiths, right? And, you know, you don't need me to tell you that. So if that holds, right, then we need to discover, and this is beyond what Jordan talks about, right? We need to discover he talks a lot about this, but also, I mean, beyond it in a political sense, not just in a philosophical sense, that I think he addresses it. We need to discover which myths are valuable to the problem we're in right now, right? And those myths, I think, need to be recognized as part of the antidote to this problem. And the stronger the lessons or the moral sort of teachings that those myths are portraying, the stronger those lessons become in us as a collective, the more likely it is that whatever comes next will be a reflection of that as opposed to what we're worried about. But it has to come down again to our collective response in a long-term context. This isn't going to be fixed by you and me, even with what we have left in our lives, doing the best we can. We're not going to end this problem. We're only going to make a small dent in a direction that will be a battle between two opposing directions that will continue way after we're dead.
Well, I think there is truth in that. I do think we have a short-term problem that we have to solve. Yeah. The system is so out of control, and the power of the technologies under its management are so great that effectively we have to figure out how to get it to behave rationally. Very short term. I don't think we can solve this over the course of generations, though there are parts of it that will have to be.
A tweak, yeah, on this current problem we have. But this problem, as you look back to history has occurred many times.
Yep.
We have to fix the one we're in.
We have to fix the one we're in, and like never before, because we've never been a threat to ourselves in this way before. That's a new problem. I will say that it's a gentle disagreement that I have with Jordan, or maybe it's just a slightly different emphasis, is that Jordan sees the timelessness of these myths. And I don't doubt that there's something that is timeless-ish in some of these myths. But what I think he misses is that because the myths are products of evolution, they too are limited to the context that formed them, right? Mm-hmm. And some of them are no longer, they may have been timeless for a long period of time, if that's a reasonable way to say it.
It's adaptation.
Well, they are, but the point is, you have to beware. If your myth was evolved in an environment that was very different than the one you're in, there's nothing that says it will be relevant to the one you're in. It could even be the inverse of relevant. It could steer you in the wrong direction. And so we have to have a mechanism for at least being aware when our myths have left us without the right tools, right? For example, I used to say that, you know, if God was writing today, then the first commandment would be, thou shalt not enrich uranium, right? Yeah. But it's not in there. He didn't mention uranium. So we don't know what to do about it. We don't know how to feel about it. And, you know, look, we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. There's history, there's traditions that got us to where we are, right? They're not up to date enough to get us through what we've got coming. And that leaves us to trying to navigate it consciously. And it's too difficult.
But it also does something else. This is I don't even know if I want to say it because it's so scary. Because I agree with everything you just said, by the way. And as you know, my work on my side of my community's myths reflects the fact that I believe certain things need to be adapted to the situation we find ourselves in today. And that was everything I was doing up until COVID. We're in a very scary position intellectually, because if what you just said stands, and I think it does, old myths are not going to address the acuteness of the very specific problem we're facing right now, which is also terminal potentially. Yeah. So it's an acute and potentially terminal problem that needs an immediate fix, not some long-term multi-generational myth conversation. We've got to fix this right now. And those long-term multi-generational myths, though they exist, even if we were to be able to draw upon them, weren't constructed or weren't a product of this specific problem they're facing. They were products of a lesser problem that was similar. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this is a big bad monster. That's why I call it a Death Star moment. Yeah. Right. We've got so the scary situation is this, finish this thought. Considering how big this problem, we have to create or adapt a new myth today to deal with this, building perhaps on everything in the past. That's the scary part.
That's the scary part.
Who's going to do that?
Well, right. And I'm afraid that we may also be in another bind here. Yeah. So if you take my premise that you can't write a myth, you can write a narrative and then evolution will shape it into a myth, if it's good. Yeah. Take the Fellowship of the Ring. Okay, the Fellowship of the Ring is a good hero's journey story that's been updated for the sort of team mentality that one would need on a world that's been scaled up, right? The villains are scaled up, the heroes are scaled up. The problem is, effectively, it's digitally rendered, right? It's printed, every copy is identical. And so the substance on which evolution should act isn't really there. What's worse for something like Star Wars or The Matrix or any one of the others, those things are compromised, because I may think The Matrix is right on target with respect to much of its message. Right?
Film one.
Yeah, film one takes Plato's cave and makes it vibrant and updates it for modern sensibilities and for the modern predicament. But it's not art. Yeah. It's a hybrid between art, the artistic vision of the Wachowskis, I guess, and the market and what it demands. And the problem is the market
won by 2 and 3.
It certainly did win in the end, although we can just purge those sequels and say, well, the first film was pretty damn good. But the problem is, I don't really trust the market to tell me anything about wisdom. That's not what the market does.
That's right.
Right? And so the point is, if my wisdom that I want to hand off to my kids is like, hey, let's watch The Matrix.
We wouldn't be sitting here if we thought that, because it's not a popular position we're in.
Right. So the point is, look, we have plugged our myth creation apparatus into the market.
Into the market.
Wow, that was dumb. There are a lot of things you don't want to plug sex and romance into the market. You don't want to plug your
that's
art
very dumb.
And myth generation.
But what I'm referencing is these myths that have come over generations.
Yeah.
There's some good there. What the scary part is, I'm saying, is the task has befallen our generation, not you and me, because who are we?
Right.
Gen X. And so Gen X up, because beyond Gen X, people don't, so Gen, maybe what's after X, Gen X, sorry, is it millennials? The millennials, the older side of millennials still do remember the days before mobile phones, just about.
Just barely.
But you need that. Why do you need that? Because you can't understand how to defeat what we're facing if you don't remember what it was like before the thing existed, because our task is to find an equilibrium. You can't get the yin and yang if you don't have half of the story.
Yeah, you've been tweeting about this.
Yeah,
right? I saw you.
BMX Bandits.
Yeah, you tweeted your BMX bike.
This is not a boomer analysis. This
right.
is something else.
Right. Now, I would point out, you know, it's fun to rag on the boomers. I like it.
No, but that's not what I'm interested in.
Right, right.
Because I think you might be a boomer, no?
No. Oh, my God. Stake through the heart.
What are you saying, man? That's defense, man. I'm not trying to be offensive.
Jesus. All right. Well, no, I'm not a boomer. Born in 1969.
So
what was I going to say? What I was going to say.
But do you agree that you need that sense of pre-mobile phones, pre-internet, to know how to find equilibrium?
You need a lot of these things.
So
the fact, you know, your point about the BMX, your first tweet that I saw at least, was about the relationship to the world that those things gave us, right? We disappeared for hour upon hour. Our parents didn't know where we were. We weren't at home. We were off doing things. Some of the things we were doing, we shouldn't have done. Sometimes we got hurt, right? But the point is, it created an entirely different mentality. And kids don't have it. If you're, especially if the vibrant part of your world is coming through screens, right? You've been hobbled because, you know, the fact is it doesn't have a normal physics to it. So this is.
So here's the scary part.
Yeah.
So where I was going with that, I'm glad you followed that actually, because this is the point that builds on it. It so becomes the duty of everybody that remembers the world before mobile phones, and I mean in their consciousness, not just, oh, I was 3 years old and my dad told me there was no mobile phones. Nah, man, you got to be the guy that had to use the payphone
right.
and didn't have the change, and had to go into the shop and ask for a note to be broken up because you had to call somebody or reverse collect calls. You got to be the guy that remembers what it was like before mobile phones and the internet, right? That's a certain age group. Let's call them 40 and above for argument's sake. Sorry, forgive me for the arbitrariness. If you're 39 and a half and you remember those days, you're included, right? That group of people, whoever they are, whichever arbitrary age is the cutoff point, it's the burden is on that group of people, and let's say arbitrarily Gen X upwards and elder millennials upwards, the burden is on that group of people to synthesize, not these marketed myths, to synthesize the actual myths that come through that are multi-generational, because they have wisdom in them and they're not driven by the market. Many of them are word of mouth through lineage, right? And that's in particular, that's how, for example, I know about the Sufi chains in Sufism, and you have to have a teacher who has a teacher who has a teacher, and it has to be traced back.
Right.
Right? So we, those who remember before and after the internet, have a responsibility to find the best of these proper wise myths and adapt them to the acute problem that you identify that is unique and is terminal potentially. That's the scary part. Because not only is that such a huge burden, it's also almost impossible to do, because myths actually, as you say, they are a product of evolution over years, right?
Yeah.
And so how do you do that? Well, luckily for us, we're not reinventing. We've got some existing material. The difficulty is the adaptation of that existing material to face this very acute danger we're facing. But you can't do it without the myths, because you're not powerful enough and I'm not powerful enough. That entire generation isn't powerful enough that we're gonna need to do that task.
Right.
But they can't even do it unless they utilize these myths, because we're all bigger. Even the current, everyone alive today is still not as big as these myths are. They will be multi-generational.
All right. So I've just realized something.
Yeah. Is that scary?
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
Here is the, equally terrifying extension to it, I think. Let's step back to what happened during COVID.
Yeah.
One of the things that happened that was very conspicuous was the relationship between doctors and patients and doctors and other doctors suddenly radically shifted. There was a distant voice that told you what the conclusion was and what it implied about how to treat your patients, and then it came at you and it ruined you if you didn't listen.
Yeah.
So the point is, doctors have a horizontal relationship with each other and they have a relationship with their patients. And that whole thing bubbles along and it does whatever it does until something decides that, you know what? Suddenly the CDC is everybody's boss, right? And to the extent that you weren't listening to the CDC, it whispered in the ear of your pharmacist and said, don't fill those prescriptions, don't fill them. All right, so that's a radical shift to a centralization. You don't realize it because the staffing of your medical building didn't change. There was a radical shift, which was the way in which a tiny, incorrect, centralizing force was distributing the same wrong information to everybody simultaneously and insisting that they listen to it and act on it as if it was right. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, think about social media. We feel like we have all of these horizontal relationships with other people, right? And we do. But there's a ghost in the machine.
Yeah.
Right? We don't know what the algorithms are. We don't know when they change. We don't know what they want. We don't know how actively we can be individually targeted. We don't know any of the things we would like to know. And so what I see is the impression that we have about, yeah, we're connected with lots and lots of people and we're interacting and we're, you know, it's like a hive mind. No, it's not a hive mind. It's something very susceptible to. Imagine that hypnosis came from within and not from outside. Like, you can note the guy outside who's trying to hypnotize you with the watch. But if that guy comes in, you know, through the brainstem, you're not going to spot it. And so, I mean, part of the, whatever you want to call it, I would say the clear collective psychosis that has accompanied the phenomena of the last couple of years is partially downstream of this.
Yeah. And this brings me to, without being rude about anyone, but a conversation about our friends.
Okay.
Because what was meant to happen in the good old days before the world went, right? It's always been bad for a while, for me at least, but still, you know what I'm referring to. It's the last 2 years, yeah? What should have happened is there was a group of people that should have been like a team.
100%.
Yeah. And should have mobilized the world, right?
100%.
Out of those group of people that I'm thinking of, you can count on one hand the number of people that did actually start doing anything.
Right. And at the very least, the ones who didn't should have said, I don't understand why people that I know full well are careful and well-intentioned have reached a conclusion I can't understand. That is not a reason to demonize them. That is a reason to become very interested. Somebody has to be wrong. Who is it? Let's figure it out.
And out of all the people you've been speaking to here in London while you've been here for Dark Horse, by the way, congratulations, man. Great podcast. Yeah,
Thank you.
It's important to say that because Robert Malone said to me, he was like, I went on Dark Horse and that's how I ended up on Rogan. You've been a springboard for many people. And without that platform, people like Malone's voice wouldn't have been heard. So that has to be acknowledged on this platform, yeah? Now, sorry, the reason I mention this is that that thing that should have happened, the group of friends we have, now, out of all the people you've interviewed while you're here, if I can be so bold as to say that you and I share a group of friends more so than the other people you speak into, including the people you've recently met, because you and I were friends before this COVID stuff happened and we're speaking about other stuff that we felt was as important that we were addressing then, right? Without recapping history. Yeah. So we've got a shared group of friends, and it might be why, you know, this is such a relaxed and lovely, enjoyable conversation. Yeah. I've dined with you and your wife, you know, you've met my wife and my wife is, as I say, follows my Substack and your wife's Substack, right? And that's pretty much the only Substack she reads because she's in a different world. She's an artist, a musician, and so on. So we've got this group of friends that we're close to that I love still, yeah? And that's why I don't want to name names, and I'm not bitching on anyone here, yeah? Because I love them still. And I've, in fact, made a point because I knew, by the way, you don't know this. They know this. The people, you all know I did this, right? The minute COVID started, I started texting my friends. I love you. It's been nice. I'm going on a bit of a journey. You might not. And I hinted, you know, I'm not going to paraphrase what I said to different people. You might not understand what's about to happen. Because I knew this would happen. I've lived this all my life with people, yeah, not knowing why I've taken the stances I've taken, including my ex-family on the extremism debate. I know what happens when you do this, which is why perhaps I saw it coming a lot faster. So I messaged those people that I'm referencing as our common friends. I love you. Randomly, without solicitation. So they know, no matter what happens, even if they don't agree with me, I'm not going to take it personally. Just don't also do the same and start attacking me. I'm your friend. Now, the reason I'm mentioning all this is we've got to a point where I believe there's been a failure of people that have a responsibility, back to the burden I just mentioned, right? There's only a certain group of people that can bear that burden for the entire generation that needs to move collectively to take our traditional myths into the next phase beyond this Death Star moment, right? The responsibility to help Gen X upwards, with the elder millennials included, carry that burden lies on a certain group of people that had posited themselves up until this moment as being ready for that burden, right? Including the fanfare in the bullshit media articles. They had posited themselves as being ready for that moment. And there was something akin to a system failure that happened in that group of friends, to a point where you can now count on one hand with fingers spare who actually addressed the COVID stuff. And it's not a personal thing for me. It's a disappointing thing for me that, because it's the kind of moment where at the moment we needed it the most, it needed to have happened. There is no more important moment than this Death Star moment.
Right. This has been.
And I'm going to say something and I'm going to repeat this. I love you all. These friends know who I'm talking about. Yeah. You missed the boat. And well, they might think I'm stupid. Nah, man. They missed the boat. You didn't.
No, I didn't.
And they missed the boat, Brett. And I'm not being, I don't mean to be dismissive of anything. They missed, there is a moment here they have missed that they have not begun to fathom. And I don't mean to be patronizing.
I hear you.
Smart people.
And I think we have to figure out what the best way forward is. And I'm going to suggest something.
Yeah.
So first of all, they did miss the boat, yeah, but it's not completely gone yet for the following reason.
Yeah. Fine. Give a rope, but jump on board, man.
Here's where I think we are. Lab leak?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
We all know what happened.
Yeah.
Right? This is clearly a modified virus. This is clearly a self-inflicted wound inflicted on humanity. Vaccine safety and effectiveness. Reasonable people can disagree over the net impact of these injections, but the idea that they were ever understood to be safe and effective is obviously preposterous.
You don't even need that, Brett. You know what? For the people I'm talking about, the minute it was mandated, your alarm bell should have stopped.
Yeah, but still.
You know what
okay?
I mean?
They told us they were safe and effective. We all know about myocarditis, right? We all know that they did not properly risk stratify by age or any of those things. They put people at risk. Were they safe? No. Were they safe enough? We can argue. But were they safe? No. If you ever said they were safe, you were wrong. Were they effective? Well, look at how many boosters you're being told they got. These are very, very weak vaccines. Not safe, not effective, have not controlled the pandemic. So that's 2 out of 3, right? We were right on 2 out of 3. Now, the sticky wicket is ivermectin, and we can argue about why that is.
And that was your main, one of your main points, wasn't it?
Well, and lots of people have the sense, right? What people say about me on Twitter,
and
or maybe
they're,
wrong. Maybe they're sock puck,
they're
wrong.
They're wrong because it hasn't been disproven.
Right, and quite the
they
opposite.
They don't realize how wrong they are.
Right, in fact, they come at me and they say, Brett can't even admit that he got ivermectin wrong. And it's like, I don't know what the hell you're paying attention to. You are still paying attention to propaganda. But here's the point.
This is the system failure I'm talking about, Brett, because the people you're talking about, I know them, you know them. What the f*** is going on?
Right, but here's the point. Okay.
They're not stupid people.
Right, but what they need to do is go back and track their own thought process.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
If you thought, well, I don't know what to think about lab leak. It is kind of suspicious that it was in Wuhan, but the vaccine seemed like a really good idea. Well, okay, now what you've discovered is that we were prescient on these two things, and maybe you think we were wrong on ivermectin, and maybe you think we're morally defective and can't admit it, or maybe we're right and you just haven't seen past the propaganda. But if we got 2 out of 3 right, and you got them wrong, aren't you interested in whether or not you might have the other one wrong too? And here's my point. I have a policy from after Evergreen. People come up to me periodically, and they say, This is not that common, but it happens periodically. They say, I am so sorry. I misunderstood Evergreen. I thought you were a jerk. I thought those students had a point. It took me a long time to understand what happened, and I feel so bad. And I always say, look, you do not owe me an apology, yeah, so long as at the point that you did realize what happened, you did the right thing.
So I had a recent chat, sit down with James Dellingpole on a Delling pod.
Yeah.
And it was a live audience. It was quite a nice gathering and stuff. And we had a chat like this, but it was more formal. I was in a three-piece. Sorry, Brett, didn't dress up for you. But you're in my studio, though.
Yeah,
so, yeah. So it's more like a homely
discussion. You dressed it up. Very nice. Yeah.
Somebody tweeted me. And it was like, they quoted a clip from the thing. And it was like, I misunderstood Majid all the way up until this event. That event was 2 weeks ago, right? And so there is a lot of this happening, but they're not the friends that I'm talking about. Now, what I'm trying to work out is we need them.
Of course.
They need to know. We need you guys, man, right?
It's
not like I'm trying to say you're a bunch of morons and we don't know you. No, you know Brett and you know me, right? That's why I'm not naming names, but you know who I'm talking. We need them speaking,
yes,
as you're speaking, because we can't do it without them.
And we need to learn the lesson of what happened.
Yeah.
How do we become divided over
this?
It's possible to be analytically divided. Yeah.
But by the way, I've never criticized any of them in public.
Right.
That's not my thing, man. You mentioned this to me the other day. I don't do that, man. Even if you disagree with me vehemently, I never go for you like that if you're my friend.
Yeah.
I'll leave you alone until you realize it for yourself.
I think I've been very gentle. I have responded publicly because in some cases, the attacks have been quite...
Obviously, I'm talking about friends though, right? Obviously, I speak in public about people.
Of course. But some of our friends have said some things that were pretty aggressive.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And very personal.
Yeah, about you.
Right.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, here's where we are. It's clear that we were right about Lab Leak, okay?
And this isn't backpatting. Guys, look at they can read.
Right.
This isn't you just backslapping and saying, I was right when you're not. You were right.
Right and early, and we withstood all the garbage.
I mean, this Together trial, they come at you on the Together trial with ivermectin. I don't know if you've obviously spoken about this on Dark Horse, but I just want to say for the record, systemic failures of research methodology in that trial that appear to be deliberate.
Yes, it is.
You can't cite that at Brett when it comes to ivermectin.
It's an outright fraud, right? And we can establish it. And the thing is, if you don't know what we're talking about, ask us. We'll show you. It's very clear. But nonetheless, here's where we are. Two out of three of these things have become clear enough that you know that what you were being told at the beginning by people like us was actually right, right? This is not safe. They've told you it's safe. Safe means they know it doesn't do harm. They were wrong. They told you it was highly effective, and now they're telling you need your fourth booster. They were wrong about that, too. So, because ivermectin is the sticky wicket, this does give an opportunity for our friends who got this wrong to actually step up at a moment that it still matters, right? And the thing is—
Yeah, so there's an incentive there. You're still a hero.
Well, I don't even, is hero.
You know, I'll say it because clearly some people are driven by it.
Right, but nonetheless, the point is, look, there's still good to be done. Right? You can still see what happened. This is a perfect place to learn what the propaganda looks like because the propaganda is still live on that one.
If they don't?
Well, look.
We can't do it without them.
Yeah. Well, we will have to.
Yeah.
We will have to. But what we need is a group that doesn't fragment over Trump or ivermectin or...
I mean, look, so my formula for this, and that's why you see me comfortable in all circles, is when you're looking at things in a macro perspective, right? So if I've got a Trump supporter sitting in front of me that is opposed to COVID mandates, and I've got a Corbyn supporter who I opposed vehemently, and obviously I'm not a Trump fan. I say obviously, I get accused of all sorts of things, right? But basically, I defend Trump where he's done, where people have... So recently I tweeted out the Wall Street Journal article because it turns out Hillary Clinton's own dude, Mook, campaign chief, Robin Mook? Mook. Yeah, that's his name. Anyway, turns out he confesses, Hillary gave the order to make up this Russia collusion stuff. And then the Wall Street Journal, so I'm going to defend the truth. It's not defending Trump, right? Likewise, Corbyn, I opposed him vehemently in this country. He knows because he lives here, yeah? I was one of the most vocal voices. But if he's going to say something right, I'll say credit where credit is due. So what we got to do, I just didn't think he needed to be PM. And anyway, the system's corrupt. So why was he trying to be PM? That's a different story. But what we got to do is be able to speak across the board to people on where the agreement matters. If this is a Death Star moment, then it doesn't matter how you vote. It matters that you're trying to stop technocratic slavery taking over. And that isn't hyperbole. As I say, look to China and see what's happening right now. Yeah, not just the Uyghur side of things, but the Shanghai lockdown and what was going on there with the videos. So what matters to me more is not how somebody votes. Yeah.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, some issues still matter there. Like, I don't believe in, you know, that even there, there are some, but let's not go into them, it would be a distraction. But there are some points there we still need to feel through. But in essence, we've got this bigger problem here, yeah? Now we've got friends that should understand that point. So it's why I'm on good terms all the way through from Rubin to Sam Harris. I've got no bad beef with any of them on a personal level, yeah? Even though clearly they're on different ends of the Trump spectrum, because you mentioned Trump. That's why I give that example. And I could text both of them tomorrow. In fact, Sam and I are texted through the pandemic, and Ruben and I texted through the pandemic, right? So there's no bad beef there with me and anyone there out of our friends. But we've got friends that have these different positions. The difficulty is, unless you see it as a Death Star moment, you're not going to be willing to transcend these differences, because you think they're the biggest differences that are defining the future of humanity at the moment. You have to be able to see it as a Death Star moment to realize they are quite insignificant compared to the risk of what we're facing at the moment.
I would say they are symptomatic.
Yeah.
If you understand Trump as a symptom, you won't go crazy over it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the fact that super smart friends of ours are not seeing that, I mean, the only reason you think Trump is the biggest thing we need to be discussing right now is if your ceiling if your bird's eye perspective, sorry, isn't flying where the eagle soars, but is flying where the blooming penguin is.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
I don't mean to be insulting, yeah, but we've got bigger problems. So how do we get that?
Well, this goes back to my principle.
Yeah.
I will embrace anybody who does the right thing upon the recognition that they misunderstood the thing and have taken time to update. That's fine by me. We're square if that's what you do. If you don't, then I'm sorry, but you're not running the IDW protocol, and there is no point in trying to interact.
That's finished, man. I mean, that grouping is not going to... We've got to... Because...
Well, the thing is, I'm a believer...
Insofar it was a cohesive group in the first place.
I'm a believer in the protocol. Yeah. And, you know, it was a prototype. It needs an update. But nonetheless, a lot of people miss it. I miss it.
I'm going to say something as well, though. Again, this is not to take away any of the love I feel from anyone, yeah?
Yeah.
But the silence is also not acceptable. Not just the open disagreement, which you've had to face, because people know me and they know I haven't attacked anyone on this stuff, even if they, out of our friend circles, obviously. Public figures, I criticize all the time. That's my job.
Sure.
But if you're a public figure and my friend, then you're friend first. That's how I feel, right? So I don't go for them publicly. They're always going to be friends first, even though people don't treat me like that. I don't care. They're my principles. But the thing is that even if you haven't, you face some of that criticism, but even the ones who haven't criticized, I'm saying the silence itself, such is the gravity of the moment we're in that you must not be silent. And that requires unpacking. And the only way you get that is you understand what the gravity of the moment we're in, which is you get, right? You understand where we are.
Yes. Well, I think we have to leave plenty of room, all the room in the world for agnosticism. It's one thing to say, I don't know what to think about this. It's very, very confusing.
That's different.
Right. That of course, that's a natural place to land. Yeah. But, you know, the silence and hoping it will go away has been very destructive.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, unfortunately, I think we're out of time, which means we'll have to do this again.
Man, listen, we can, because one of the things I'm going to do, can I just end on this point? Yeah. So the show that you see there, Radical, it's more of a interview show for some of the big topics on what we just touched on, right? So for example, I had on one of the episodes coming out will be with Mike Eden, who is the senior most person at Pfizer on respiratory illnesses around the world, talking to me about everything we've discussed, why everything was wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a more, you're the expert, tell me, yeah?
Yeah.
There's another show I'll be starting soon. No one has heard this yet. You're hearing it first.
Awesome.
On your podcast. It'll be a second show I'm going to kick off, which is a live show, whereas the interview show is currently pre-recorded. We'll get that live soon, but at the moment, that's pre-recorded. This new one, which give me a month or so, will roll out, is a live format show, which will be more like a sit-down conversation, but more lifestyle topics. And that lifestyle topics will include politics. Yeah. But I'm saying it's more relaxed, like this kind of chat than what I'm currently doing. What I'm currently doing is because we're addressing like, you know, care home deaths and, you know, victims whose husbands have died or wives have died. It's a heavy conversation. Whereas this is, you can have a more of a coffee house conversation. That's what we're going to be starting. And The reason I'm telling you that is that's what you want to continue the conversation. You're welcome to join me on that one. And part two can be on that format.
Would love to. Yeah. Does it have a name? Are you?
Not yet. That's how new it is. Yeah. But the name's the last. I mean, that's easy to fix. Yeah. The key thing is it's going to happen soon. And because it's live streaming, we don't need anything. We're just going to be sitting here like this. We'll put an iPod there, put the phone, and just start, you know. My buddy, brother, long-term friend, you know, say he's my brother of mine, you know, Usman Raja, who's also, I train MMA with him. He came up through the UK bare knuckle fist fighting scene in the old days before UFC, so in the pit fights, and then he became one of the top coaches in the country. So he and I, you know, basically he's going to be joining me, and it'll be, that's why I say wellness, health, lifestyle, because what we touched on at the beginning, when I said that, you know, whether it's architecture, whether everything touches on this, we've got to start pushing back against the encouraged narcissism and try and encourage community as much as possible. Anyway, so that's the show.
Awesome. Well, let me say this. I said this to Tess Laurie a couple days ago. Nobody wants to live in a foxhole, but the company in this foxhole has been spectacular. And I just want to say it's been an honor to share a foxhole with you.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. And honestly, it's why I'm so happy that we finally got to sat down, because it's been a journey through COVID and you've had it hard, man. So we're always here for you anytime you need.
Likewise. Yeah. All right.
Love to have it, yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
You have been listening to a conversation recorded in the end of June 2022 in London, England, between Brett Weinstein and Majid Nawaz. Brett Weinstein, Weinstein, has a podcast called The Dark Horse Podcast, and Majid Nawaz has a show on the Odyssey video website, odyssee.com, called Radical. You can also follow the both of them on Twitter, at Majid Nawaz, MAJIDNAWAZ, and at Brett Weinstein, with Brett with one T. Weinstein is Weinstein. Majid Nawaz and Brett Weinstein, two free-thinking individuals who are very important to the continued education of people not willing to look at the larger picture. Now, next on the show, from the Academy of Ideas channel on YouTube, The Parallel Society versus Totalitarianism, How to Create a Free World. This segment is approximately 12 minutes long.
The real question is whether the brighter future is always so distant. What if it has been here for a long time already, and only our own blindness and weakness have prevented us from seeing it around us and within us, and kept us from developing it? Across the globe, a confluence of factors is destabilizing the fabric of society. Many government institutions are corrupt to the core. Many politicians are so detached from reality that they view those who want freedom as enemies. The legacy media has morphed into the propaganda arm of the government. Instead of seeking the truth, the function of these institutions is to augment state power and demonize those who dissent. To make matters worse, global economies have been ravaged by destructive government policies, and while rampant money printing has created a mirage of economic stability, this mirage is quickly giving way to an ugly reality. Politicians tell us that if we are unhappy with the way we are ruled, then we can express our displeasure at the polls, or even run for office. But this is to assume that the democratic ideal is the best way to return freedom to an unfree world. This is to overlook the corrupting influence of state power. This is to forget that the massive bureaucratic class that operates many of the levers of government is not replaced through elections. And finally, this is to assume that state power is the solution to what ails society. Perhaps state power is the poison that is destroying it. A more practical solution to what ails the modern world may be to allow the dead weight of the state to collapse in on itself, as it inevitably will, and to soften the blow of this collapse through the creation of a parallel society. In this video, we are going to explore what a parallel society is, how it played a pivotal role in the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, and how the creation of a parallel society may be our best chance of returning freedom to an authoritarian world. If it proves impossible legally to compel the ruling power to change the ways it governs us, and if for various reasons those who reject this power cannot or do not wish to overthrow it by force, then the creation of an independent or alternative or parallel society is the only dignified solution. The basis for the parallel society was born in the mind of Ivan Jiroš, a Czech poet and the artistic director of the rock band The Plastic People of the Universe. After members of this band were arrested in 1976 for refusing to toe the government line, Jiroš called on the community of Czech artists to create music labels, publishing houses, concert halls, art expositions, and other such infrastructure that existed independently of mainstream society and outside the grasp of the communist state. Jiroš hypothesized that if enough infrastructure were created, an independent society would spontaneously form and function as a pocket of creative freedom in a highly oppressed society. Jiroš defined the independent society as a society not dependent on official channels of communications or on the hierarchy of values of the establishment, and as he further explained, the independent society does not compete for power. Its aim is not to replace the powers that be with power of another kind, but rather under this power, or beside it, to create structures that respect other laws, and in which the voice of the ruling power is heard only as an insignificant echo from a world that is organized in an entirely different way. Jiroš's idea caught the attention of the Czech Catholic philosopher and mathematician Václav Benda. Benda saw in this idea the seeds of a non-violent solution to the destructiveness of communism. However, for the independent society to have real-world social and political impact, it needed to be extended beyond the realm of music and the arts. For the stifling bureaucracy and heavy hand of the communist government was suffocating all areas of life. And so Benda coined the phrase parallel society to refer to all social, cultural, and economic structures that existed unconstrained by the state. He called such structures parallel structures, and at the height of political oppression in the late 1970s, Benda urged Czech citizens to begin creating parallel forms of education and science and scholarship, parallel political structures, a parallel information network, and free parallel markets that form a parallel economy. And as H. Gordon Skilling explains, outlining the parallel structures which had come into existence or might do so in the future, Benda argued that these might gradually supplant or at least humanize the existing official structures. The rationale behind the creation of parallel structures in the parallel society was simple. As the communist government had a monopoly on force and was too powerful to challenge head-on, it was best to turn away from it and defy it by ignoring it as much as possible. Rather than trying to eliminate oppressive state structures, it was better to build up better ones that could function as alternatives or replacements to the establishment system that was in the process of dying. A well-known communist dissident, Yasik Kuran, captured this rationale in 1980 when he responded to the torching of a communist headquarters by stating, "Stop burning down committees, let us build our own." Or as Ivan Jiroš explained, "The parallel society began in spontaneous acts of mutual self-defense in different parts of society. Those who take part are active people who can no longer stand to look passively at the general decay, rigidity, bureaucracy, and suffocation of every living idea or sign of movement in the official sphere. And because these people sooner or later recognize that efforts to bring about the slightest improvements in the official sphere were exercises in futility, it was only a matter of time before they said, why not invest our talents, abilities, goodwill, and enthusiasm into something that no one will be able to corrupt, that we will be able to decide about ourselves in the end? The parallel society provided individuals the means to express themselves freely without fear of censorship and to fulfill their goals and aims without being suffocated by the bureaucracy of the state. Furthermore, individuals felt that by turning towards parallel structures and away from the establishment structures that functioned as vehicles of the state, they were influencing society for the better. The parallel society thus served as a much-needed source of hope in a society which had succumbed to apathy due to decades of communist rule. And in the latter half of the 1970s and throughout the 1980s, this hope inspired people throughout all of Eastern Europe, and the parallel society infiltrated many areas of culture and the economy. Even my most audacious expectations have been considerably surpassed, wrote Benda in 1988. It is no longer necessary to show that the parallel society is possible. By the late 1980s, the parallel society in Eastern Europe had become so strong, decentralized, and decoupled from the state that the communist authorities lost their grip on power. The revolution which swept through Eastern Europe in the closing months of 1989 was a spontaneous product of the massive discontent and the yearning for freedom of the peoples of those countries. It was also a culmination of the independent activities of many citizens as they sought to defend their rights against the party-state system, and to create a parallel or independent society as a challenge and an alternative to it. One of the more famous examples of a parallel structure was the underground film industry in Romania. The communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu outlawed the possession and distribution of Western films. However, the entrepreneur Teodor Zamfir created a vast underground market smuggling Western films into the country and then translating and dubbing them into Romanian. The demand for the films rapidly grew, and as the Romanian people were exposed to Western culture, their eyes were opened to the full extent of their own oppression. As one Romanian dissident put it, the seeds of freedom that were planted by the films grew. Zamfir made a fortune off this parallel market and he became one of the most powerful men in Romania. And in an interview for a 2015 documentary, Zamfir explained, "During the 1989 revolution, everybody was in the streets because they all knew there was a better life out there. How? From films." Given advances in technology and the capacity to spread information, goods, and services across the world, the potential to create a wide variety of parallel structures on both a local and global level is significantly greater today than it was in communist Eastern Europe. And so rather than passively waiting for a political savior to bring us freedom and save us from societal collapse, a more realistic strategy is to actively participate in the construction of a parallel society. We must create all kinds of independent parallel structures, that is, structures unmanipulated by totalitarian power. Contributing to the creation of a parallel society could amount to, among many possibilities, consuming independent media instead of legacy media, using alternative mediums of exchange rather than government-backed fiat currencies, using social media platforms and decentralized digital infrastructures that promote freedom of expression, or supporting local businesses rather than global corporations that further the agenda of the political establishment. It could amount to creating self-sustainable communities, conducting scientific inquiry or scholarship free of institutional pressures, or consuming and creating educational resources, art, music, or literature that pays no heed to the establishment status quo. Any action or enterprise that expands the realm of freedom while creatively circumventing censorship and top-down authoritarian or totalitarian control is a boon to the parallel society. For as Egon Bundy, one of the leading figures of the Czech underground, explained, "When the activity of those who oppose the establishment becomes articulated, it will be in forms, methods, and ideas that are totally unknown, incomprehensible, and unacceptable to members of the establishment, and that is how it should be." Once a parallel society is sufficiently established, a society is no longer under the same grave danger as when it relies solely on the structures and institutions that are appendages of the tyrannical state. For if these establishment structures collapse, parallel structures will soften the blow of an economic or social breakdown. Furthermore, parallel structures cater to the authentic needs and wants of the people rather than the political class, and so they tend to be more life-promoting than the establishment structures. As parallel structures develop and solidify, more and more people will instinctively turn towards them, and as the parallel society expands, so too does the sphere of cultural, economic, and political freedom. A genuine parallel society would, by a process of metastasis, penetrate all the important social structures. And as Václav Havel further explains, "The ultimate phase of this process is the situation in which the official structures simply begin withering away and dying off, to be replaced by new structures that have evolved from below and are put together in a fundamentally different way." In 1988, a year before communism in Eastern Europe collapsed, Ivan Jurus reflected on the growth of the parallel society and on the dramatic social changes that were following in the wake. "The parallel society has proven its worth," he wrote, "and it is the only meaningful structure that people can create if they do not wish to remain mere appendices of the political and social structures created by the ruling power." Learn more about our membership, access transcripts, and the art we use in the videos by visiting academyofideas.com.
That was titled The Parallel Society versus Totalitarianism, How to Create a Free World, from the Academy of Ideas channel on YouTube. My show runs every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. this summer on 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. I'll see you next week with more information.
WMFO Live Day returns to the airwaves this Saturday, July 9th, from 8 a.m. until 1 p.m. We'll be broadcasting 5 hours of prime live performances by local artists, recorded in WMFO Studios A&D, plus even more music from legendary Boston rocker Sal Baglio and WMWM Live Days. So tune in to 91.5 on the FM airwaves or access our streaming at WMFO.org this Saturday, July 9th, beginning at 8 a.m. for one authentic local live music performance after another right up until 1 p.m. Only here on WMFO in Medford, Tufts Freeform, non-commercial community radio.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time. As in, spaghetti sandwiches for dinner? They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit adoptuskids.org brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Today we decided to walk to school. At the corner, we waited to cross the street. The stoplight counted down. 15, 14, 41,
31, I mean 13.
We took a left on Carroll Garden Street.
Garden Street?
Loud music was coming from a car. Danny's a smart kid, but he gets so distracted.
There were so many other sounds, I didn't know what to focus on.
Danny, Earth to Danny. Suddenly, he realized he forgot his homework again.
I left my homework on the table.
At the school steps, we hugged goodbye. I really hope he doesn't have another bad day at school today.